June 1944. A group of American women journalists gather in London to wait for D-Day, the start of the major offensive against Germany in the Second World War. When it happens, one of the women, Martha Gellhorn, smuggles herself on a hospital ship. She's one of the best known of these reporters for her marriage to the writer Ernest Hemingway, but also for her vivid writing. June 1944 was a turning point for women reporting from war zones. They all faced opposition on many fronts. They all eventually prevailed. They reached front lines, entered Paris, sent dispatches from Normandy, and later from concentration camps across Europe. I'm Lise Doucette. This is the story of the D-Day Dames, the American women who covered the greatest story of their generation, a defining moment still being felt today by women war correspondents.
There was this sort of protective attitude about we mustn't let women get into dangerous situations.
Helen Kirkpatrick, speaking on the 60th anniversary of D-Day. During the Blitz of London, she worked for the Chicago Daily News. By the time D-Day approached, she was the bureau chief for her newspaper, the only woman on the committee responsible for planning press coverage.
And there was some question before D-Day as to whether women were to be permitted to go into the front line, so to speak.
The story of Kirkpatrick and other women war correspondents is told in a definitive book on the subject, The Women Who Wrote the War, by the author Nancy Sorrell Caldwell. Speaking 20 years ago, she described how Kirkpatrick came to become a war correspondent.
She came to Europe to go to the League of Nations. She had a wonderful time there, went home. There was no job for a woman with these wonderful new credentials that she had. Of course, she made the big mistake. Well, if I can't get a job, I'll get married. So she got married, and then she realized that was not the right choice. So she set off for Europe again, and when she got to the furthest point eastward, which was Vienna, she cabled back to her husband, not returning.
Another reporter who started in Europe at an early age was Martha Gellhorn.
I wished to be a foreign correspondent, and it just seemed to me the most natural thing in the world to set off with whatever it was, $50 or so, and go to Paris and be a foreign correspondent 2 days later.
Gellhorn's first experience of war reporting before the Second World War came in Spain in the 1930s with her future husband, Ernest Hemingway. They were based in Madrid and covered the Civil War. Gellhorn's biographer, Caroline Moorhead, gives more details about her start in journalism.
When she got there, Hemingway said to her, "Why aren't you writing about the war?" And she said, "Well, I don't know about weapons and battles." And he said to her, "Well, write about what you do know about, which is people." And that started her writing, her particular style as a war correspondent, which was to write about casualties of war, the victims, the bystanders, the outsiders, and not about the military.
She went to the Caribbean with Hemingway until the pull of the war eventually brought her back to London in 1943. Meanwhile, another woman who had stayed in London during the years when Gellhorn was away had discovered her calling. But Lee Miller's career had taken a very different track to that of Gellhorn. She was a model in America in 1927. Then she decided to become a photographer. In Paris, she studied with Man Ray. Her son, Anthony Penrose, explains how she arrived in London in September 1939.
Straight away, she started work at Vogue magazine as a freelance photographer photographing fashion. And as soon as the Blitz began, she was harvesting these images of the destruction.
In 1942, Miller was accredited as a war correspondent for Vogue magazine.
Lee began photographing women at war, you know, the ATS, the Wrens.
Miller was far from typical of other American war correspondents at that time, but there is a remarkable photograph of her in 1942 with a group of six women. They're all wearing the uniforms worn by women war correspondents then. Along with Lee Miller and Helen Kirkpatrick, there was another woman in that photograph, Mary Welsh. She also ended up marrying Ernest Hemingway, whom she met in May 1944 at London's Dorchester Hotel. They were all waiting for the start of the D-Day invasion, and Martha Gellhorn was there too. Gellhorn had traveled from the Caribbean alone on a freight ship. Her relationship with Hemingway had ended. He went to London ahead of her.
Do nothing till you hear from me.
And he even signed up to cover the invasion for Collier's Magazine, the same publication Gellhorn wrote for. So that meant they wouldn't accredit her to cover the war for them. Gellhorn's biographer Caroline Moorhead explains the rivalry in this relationship.
She had already really left Hemingway. I mean, they were not really together, and some of her letters written on the way over show the extent to which she thought the marriage was over. One, in a sense, all highly competitive with each other as to who was going to get to France first. And, you know, who was, in a way, led by Hemingway, who was very gung-ho about the whole thing, you know, macho, you know, we men are going to go and cover it and you women can't. They were not allowed to go with combat troops at that stage, these women, and he was number one, which was very galling for her because she'd worked for years for Collier's.
In London, the plot thickened.
However, she went to the Dorchester to see him because he had, in the middle of the night, run into a bollard and hit his head. And she found him propped up in bed, swathed in bandages, with Mary Welsh, who was to become his fourth wife. And there was a rather anguishing scene when she felt extremely left out and put down.
Gellhorn's marriage was over, but her reputation as a war correspondent was about to take off.
This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightning. Lightning over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sun is blazing down brightly now. It's almost like an omen, the way it suddenly come out just as we were going in.
D-Day dawned on the 6th of June. Helen Kirkpatrick, bureau chief for her newspaper, was actively involved in planning press coverage.
Those of the press who hadn't made the landings in France, and we kept getting reports back by radio from the beaches, from General Eisenhower. He joined us when he returned, having made the trip to the beaches, the initial landings.
The writer Nancy Sorrell Caldwell explains how American newspapers prepared to cover the invasion.
Everyone knew, including all the papers back home, that there was going to be an invasion of Normandy at some point. No one knew exactly when. And they would need to have enough reporters present to cover a wide front. The major papers already had several correspondents over there, one perhaps in each possible front, all still in England at this point. Other papers had not planned as well as they might, and they didn't have as many as they wanted, so they decided to send over some women.
Some of the women were famous in their own right. Gellhorn and Hemingway had been a celebrity couple, and she was also a published novelist. And Margaret Burke White, the photographer for Life magazine, also had a high profile. She was photographed by Lee Miller standing by an American bomber. In her book, Caldwell also offers vivid pen portraits of some of the other women. Ruth Cowan of the Associated Press had arrived via Algiers, where she was cold-shouldered by the men. She drafted a cable to the American president's wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, saying, "Don't encourage more women to come to Africa. The men don't want us here." The cable was never sent, but conditions eventually improved for her. Lee Carson had been Washington INS reporter for several years. Caldwell says if there had been a prize for glamour, she would have shared it with Iris Carpenter, an English woman who signed on with the Boston Globe. Also from Boston, Catherine Coyne with the Herald.
So the women who read the Boston Herald said, well, where's our woman? Where's our woman reporter over there? And there wasn't one. So they looked around and here was Catherine Coyne. She was tall and quite beautiful. Almost all these reporters were quite beautiful. They said, well, how would you like to go? This was about April. Oh, she'd love to go. Well, when could she go? Well, when did they want her to go? Oh, right away. So they somehow or other managed to get her on a troop ship. And off she went. And she arrived in Liverpool. It was very shortly after that that D-Day happened.
As the invasion approached, there was growing anticipation in London. This is how Gellhorn's biographer Caroline Moorhead describes it.
Everybody knew it was coming. Nobody knew quite when it was coming. But it was very exciting. Every day you got up not knowing whether that was the day when everybody was going to cross to France.
Helen Kirkpatrick's preparation for D-Day resumed after she was recalled from Italy. She was on the Correspondence Committee. The British, Canadians and Americans met weekly to plan. In a letter to her family written 2 weeks after the invasion started, she recounts what happened. I can't tell you how relieved I was when the show started. Finally, one morning at 6 a.m., the phone rang, and I was told to get on my horse and go to headquarters. So I did.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is a special bulletin read by John Snagg. D-Day has come. Early this morning, the Allies began the assault on the northwestern face of Hitler's European fortress.
But if Kirkpatrick was at the heart of the press pack, Gellhorn was an outsider.
I was on the run from the American Public Relations Office because I had no papers and I had sneaked onto a hospital ship, locked myself in to get to D-Day. Somebody probably on shore asked me what I was doing and I said, I'm just going on this ship to interview the nurses, a woman's feature. You could always get by with that. Some wonderful ramp. It always sounded harmless and idiotic, and you could, under many circumstances, particularly Vietnam, it worked a treat. I'm just doing the woman's angle, and nobody was interested anymore. And then I just locked myself in a toilet.
Gellhorn's biographer, Caroline Moorhead, speculates on what motivated her.
She was a fiercely determined woman. She didn't want to miss out on what she saw as being the fun, which was the end of the war and going into Europe. Getting across the channel was a stunt, and the sort of stunt that she would most enjoy. And it was her pitting her wits against the boring bureaucracy.
Gellhorn wrote up about her experience for Collier's magazine, and it was published in the same edition as a piece by Hemingway, her ex-husband. It must have felt like sweet revenge. Years later, she read her story for a television profile.
When night came, the water ambulances were still churning into the beach, looking for the wounded. We waded ashore in water to our waist, having agreed that we would assemble the wounded from this area on board a beached LST and wait until the tide allowed the water ambulance to come back for us. Everyone was violently busy on that crowded, dangerous shore. The pebbles were the size of melons, and we stumbled up a road that a huge shovel was scooping out. We walked with the utmost care between white tape lines that marked the mine-cleared path. Suddenly our flak started going up at the far end of the beach, and it was beautiful, twinkling as it burst in the sky, and the tracer bullets were lovely, as they always are, and no one took pleasure from the beauty of the scene.
Gellhorn was the first woman to report on the invasion. It was an amazing scoop.
And she came back to London, and she wrote an excellent piece and sent it off to Collier's. And the good thing was that meanwhile, Hemingway, in a very gung-ho way, had got himself onto a landing craft and sailed over to France, only for one reason or another, it couldn't land. I think she was infuriated by these restrictions placed on women. She was called in by the military authorities and reprimanded and sent off as punishment to a nurse's training hall somewhere in the English countryside. And in due course, she got away, not wishing to hang around, and she went to an airport where she found one of the landing fields, where she found a young pilot who was, in fact, on his way to Italy. And she hitched a lift with him and then joined the Allies as they moved up through Italy.
Gellhorn left for Italy. Meanwhile, women war correspondents started arriving in Normandy. The writer Nancy Sorrell Caldwell explains.
Most of the women came a little bit later and lived with the nurses in one place or another, or lived with the WACs where they were stationed. There was a little group of which Marjorie Avery and Catherine Coyne were among them and a few others, and they were in an apple orchard. They were living in tents in an apple orchard. That's where they spent their first month in Normandy. They were not very close to the fighting lines, but they were close enough to hear the artillery, to hear the bombs and such.
It was a few weeks later that Lee Miller first went across to a field hospital, just behind Omaha Beach. Anthony Penrose has a copy of that article that she wrote for Vogue.
This is Lee Miller's article from La Cambe, and it was published in September 1944, titled Unarmed Warriors, and it starts off with a full-page spread of the inside of the operating theatre, the tent hospital.
Penrose and his daughter Amy have dramatised some of Miller's writing and photography. Amy reads a segment from this article.
The sky and sea joined in careless watercolor wash. Below, two convoys speckled the fragile smooth surface of the channel. Cherbourg was a misty bend far to the right, and ahead three planes were returning for dropping the bombs which made towering columns of smoke. That was the front. A green valley up from a wide, busy beach had been a battleground, and at the top, a new cemetery was being dug for 6,000 American dead. No other sign of war than neatly laid out tents with dazzling Red Cross markers. It was France. The trees were the same with little pantaloons like eagles, and the walled farms, the austere Norman architecture. We strapped ourselves in for a bumpy landing on the airstrip, but set down more smoothly than we traveled. I found that it was no longer France, but a vast military area of planes, soldiers, and gargantuan material.
The trip was followed a few weeks later by an extraordinarily dramatic episode. Miller had gone to Saint-Malo.
This was her very first combat experience. She wasn't supposed to be anywhere near combat, but she pitched up in Saint-Malo, having been told that the fighting was over.
Miller's granddaughter, Amy, reads the resulting article.
The boy at the phone said they hear airplanes. We waited, and then we heard them swelling in the air like I've heard them vibrating over England on some such mission. This time, they were bringing their bombs to the crouching stonework 700 yards away. They were on time. Bombs away! A sickly death rattle as they straightened themselves up and plunged into the citadel. Deadly hit. For a moment I could see where and how, and then it was swallowed up in smoke, belching, mushrooming and columning, towering up, black and white. Our house shuddered and stuff flew in at the windows, more bombs crashing, thundering, flashing like Vesuvius, the smoke rolling away in a sloping trail. I shouted in a kraut dugout, squatting under the ramparts, my heel ground into a dead, detached hand. And I cursed the Germans for the sordid, ugly destruction they had conjured up in this once beautiful town. I wondered where my friends that I'd known before the war were. How many had been forced into disloyalty and degradation? How many had been shot, starved, for what? I picked up the hand and hurled it across the street and ran back the way I'd come.
When the Germans surrendered, Miller was there to record it, and when her fellow correspondents arrived, they didn't recognise the woman they had known in London.
Sherman was Lee Miller's wartime buddy, and Sherman was there reporting for Life magazine at the end of the siege, and suddenly he bumps into Lee, and I think he was absolutely astonished, because there she was, indistinguishable from the GIs. He said he was walking along and he heard this voice call out, "Hey, mister, take my picture, put it in the paper," which was the kind of, you know, sort of GI response to the journalists, and he turned around and there was Lee. He hadn't spotted her as being any different to the soldiers.
And just as with Gellhorn, the authorities took a dim view of Miller's unauthorized reports, in part because she also captured a photograph of the use of napalm during a bombing raid.
She was definitely not supposed to be in a combat zone. And so as soon as the fighting was over, she was actually then placed under arrest. And they let her go just in time to make it through for the liberation of Paris.
For Miller, Paris was particularly important, as she explains in a letter to her editor at Vogue magazine.
Dear Audrey, I won't be the first woman journalist in Paris by any means, but I'll be the first dame photographer, I think, unless someone parachutes in. We're supposed to leave at 7 o'clock, and that's an hour from now, and I'm dead beat. I made an application to be assigned to the 83rd Division, but it was refused. So, it's Paris for me. Anyway, I guess I'm the only dame who's really covered a battle.
The women travelled across Europe to the concentration camps. It had the most profound impact on them. Miller had herself photographed in Hitler's bath. But the war took a huge personal toll on her, as her son Anthony Penrose explains.
Today we would understand that she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, and quite a lot could be done to help her. But there was no understanding in those days. You put up, you shut up, you drank a lot of whiskey. and she entered into a downward spiral of depression and alcohol abuse that took her 20 years to claw her way up out of. She hid her entire collection of photography and manuscripts and maps and everything in cardboard boxes in the attic of Farley Farmhouse, which is where we are today. It's where she lived, in Sussex. And it was a matter of complete fluke that my late wife, Susanna, discovered it after Lee Miller had died. And the first thing that she brought to me, it was the manuscript from the Siege of San Marlo. It was so vivid, I could not believe that it was my mum that had written this. And that's what drew me in. And that was 35 years ago. And it has been the most amazing journey ever since.
All the women waged personal battles to get to the front. Martha Gellhorn deals with it in the play she writes with fellow correspondent Virginia Cowles. The play, Love Goes to Press, was performed to some acclaim in London after the war. In it, we hear the authentic voice of Gellhorn railing against the authorities. It's read by the actress Heidi Armbruster, who performs in the play when it was revived 2 years ago in New York.
You don't care about anything except your own measly little authority. All Joe can think about is whether Annabelle will get a better story than he ever got just because she's a woman. That's all you care about in this war. You only care about whether everyone's got travel orders. You seem to think she's gone on this trip just to cause you trouble. And if she got killed or captured or deformed for life, you'd only be furious because she hadn't done it through the proper channels.
As I've narrated this story of the D-Day dames, I'm sure you'll have thought, as I have, how much has changed since 1944. And yet questions are still being asked today about women on the front line. Questions like, are there enough women reporting on war? What still holds them back? And do women cover conflict differently than men? 70 years on, the issues that confronted the D-Day dames haven't entirely gone away. In recent years, some colleagues, including American women correspondents, told me they were stopped from going to the front lines by editors because they were women. That's far more rare now, and the earlier bans on women reporters would be unthinkable now. In my own reporting over the past 30 years, it's never been mentioned to me, not once. As more and more women correspondents use their storytelling skills to report the defining moments of our time, history will be made when all of us, men and women, are judged by how good our work is, not by our gender. The D-Day dames brought us distinctive and daring chronicles of the Second World War, not just because they were women, but because they were great journalists.